Welcome to Stumptown Trade Review. I'm Brian.
And this is Thor.
And we are your online podcast source for independent trade paperback reviews. You can find us online at stumptowntradereview.blogspot.com. There's online reviews, there's video, our podcast, everything you need. This week we are talking about Young Liars, Volume 1 by David Lapham. I think I've got that pronounced right.
Daydream Believer
for a mere $9.99 for 6 issues of fun coming from DC's Vertigo imprint. So, yeah.
Did you happen to read the introduction?
I did. Who would have thunk it that Gerard Way of My Chemical Romance used to be a shopping cart pusher who was totally into smoking cigarettes and slacking off?
I actually didn't read it. How was it?
It was a rock star who used to smoke lots of cigarettes and push shopping carts for a living. I mean, it really wasn't anything terribly exciting, and he clearly didn't know a whole lot about David Lapham. He started off about 4 years into Lapham's career. Lapham started out actually working for Valiant back in the earliest days of Valiant as a writer on titles such as Harbinger and Exo Man of War, and then moved over to David Shooter's Defiant Comics, where he helped create Warriors of Plasm. And from there he went on to do Stray Bullets, which I think is where most people know him from.
That's where I started reading him.
And then most recently he's been doing a lot of DC and Marvel work. He did a really nice run on Batman, and then just did the graphic novel Silverfish. But this is his return to monthly comics. And yeah, he's definitely going for something ambitious here. You know, the action starts out big in the first chapter and just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. I don't know if he ever really stops and slows down at all in this.
One thing I have to ask you, did you actually, like, listen to the music while you read it?
I didn't. Did you?
I did, yeah. I happened to be in front of my computer, and so I looked up everything on YouTube, and there's 2 songs for each chapter.
Uh-huh.
And so I'd kind of just go back and forth between each song as I read it. And it was really interesting. I think it definitely made it a more intense read.
Really? So it added to the experience?
I think so. There was definitely, I mean, it was more like some parts it didn't really seem to fit in the chapter, but there were some parts where you definitely felt like it was much mm-hmm. more intense, and really described kind of the tone of the chapter.
Oh, I'll have to go back and do that. So, I mean, I think one of the things you hit on there is just the intensity and the feel for it, that this is really an intense, over-the-top type experience that he's going for. This is something that he builds and builds and builds, and there just isn't a moment's rest. He keeps layering more on top of more on top of more.
I really felt uncomfortable while I was reading this. I don't know if you did. It was a very unsettling feeling. I don't know. Did you have any sense of that?
Oh, is it unsettling in what? Like the characters were unsettling, or the plot was unsettling?
I guess the relationships. Have you read Invisible Monsters by Planiuk?
No, I haven't.
It's about somebody that blows their face off with like a shotgun or something, uh-huh. and the whole story is this really weird, creepy, intense sort of relationship between these 3 people. And it was just like this unsettling feeling, and it really reminded me of that.
I can see that, because, I haven't read that one, but I read Haunted and Fight Club and some of his shorter stories. And there are a lot of the same ideas, the characters in here. I mean, these characters are not pleasant people. I mean, there's only one character in here that is at all redeeming, and that's Donnie the transvestite. And I think that he's setting that up for a specific purpose, that he's the only one.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, yeah, just like with the, you know, Fight Club guy. It's that kind of idea where just the characters are so incredibly painful to look at and read about.
Abhorrent, like.
But you find yourself associating with them in some very creepy parts of your soul, and that's,
I guess that's probably the unsettling part of it. You know, you recognize, mm-hmm. you know, shitty things that you've done in the past that have kind of mirrored this, and it's like looking in a mirror at the rawest, you know, part of yourself. I think one of the things he said in here was like penetrating a wound.
Yeah.
And I think that really is an apt description for the overall feel of it, for me at least.
Yeah, it is. I think, though, that one of the problems I had with the book was that he just goes so far to make that point, that this is so uncomfortable, and he's layered so much on top of it that at times it becomes jarring and actually pulls you out of it a little bit. I think that, you know, the character of Sadie, who is the... She's not necessarily the main character, but she's the character that the whole story forms around. You know, I think that she just becomes so over the top in places that it becomes unbelievable. I mean, I think the most jarring part of the book that, I mean, it took me a couple of times to get through it, had nothing to do with the, you know, gross or, you know, violent elements. It was when she was behind the cruise ship water skiing on a service tray. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I know what he was going for there, but it was just so jarring that it took me out of the story.
I didn't even notice that it was a serving tray. That even makes it all the more ridiculous.
I mean, it was just one of those moments where I know what he's trying to do. He's trying to build this character to show how far she's come and how much she has changed from how she was before the story, which we get glimpses at. But, you know, I think that his attempt to make her so far beyond what she was is really what has pushed it over the limit in a couple of places.
Definitely.
You know, the other thing I thought was interesting was that he uses for character names things that are very familiar and almost seem like shortcuts. So the main character, the character that we're actually following through this, is Danny Noonan, which is the main character from Caddyshack.
Yeah. I noticed that too. Yeah.
Sadie goes by Sadie Dawkins, which is very close to Sadie Hawkins, which, you know, she's the, you know, the very forward woman, and, you know, where we get the Sadie Hawkins dance from. They're being chased through the entire book by the Pinkertons, which was a private police force used by industrialists in the late 19th and early 20th century. So he is taking some real shortcuts here to draw us in. And again, it at times it works. I think the Pinkertons are a pretty clever use, but at other times I think that it's very jarring. I mean, the Danny Noonan part took me a little while to get over as well.
Yeah, I did as well.
One of the things that you and I have talked about in the past is art, and I read comics for the writing. And I think the art is along for almost for the ride. It has a purpose, but I have a hard time when art is the focus of a story, which is my problem with early Image comics, is that they were all art and no story. I really liked the art in this. I thought that the art in the book was fantastic. I thought that he did a really good job of making the The characters all unique and individual. It was very clear who each of the characters were, no matter where they were, no matter what circumstance they were in. Even Donnie the transvestite later on in the book is almost incognito when they're on the cruise ship, mm-hmm. but yet it still is very clear that that's Donnie. All the characters are
also on the cruise ship. There's that Pinkerton that's dressed like an old lady,
uh-huh.
and you, I mean, the first time going through, I just didn't really, I thought that she looked really fucked up,
uh-huh.
but I didn't really think about it. I just thought maybe that was the art style that they were going for. And then, like, later it's revealed that it's a Pinkerton in a disguise. And I thought that was really good, really well represented, because she just does not look right.
Right.
As everybody else really kind of does.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I liked about the art. And also, as you said, you know which characters are mm-hmm. which at all times. And even through, I mean, like, Donnie, you can recognize him as a woman or as a man.
Right, right.
And I thought that was really pretty impressive.
Well, and that's the thing, too, is that, the women that are supposed to be beautiful, like Sadie, are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the women that are supposed to be scary, like Annie X, are scary.
They are.
And, he has a really, really firm grasp on character and anatomy that, really just shows a lot of detail and work going into it instead of taking a lot of the shortcuts that other people might use. I was really reminded, actually, of Pia Guerra from Why the Last Man in the art, that I thought it was really very similar in that all the characters were realistic and well represented, and it was easy to pick out who was who in every situation.
The difference that I have to say with that, though, is that with Why the Last Man, like, every chick was hot. Like, everybody was hot. There was really very few ugly people in that book. And with this one, it's just, that's not true. Like, almost everybody is ugly.
That's true.
Except for the hot people are hot.
Right. That is true. It is, and I think that's setting up the world that Lapham wants us to see, is that this is an ugly, seedy world, that even, the cruise ship that's supposed to be luxury is really, over the hill or, past their prime, people sitting around doing, scrapbooking type stuff instead of the things that the Carnival Cruise Line ads show us on TV.
Yeah. And I like that, because I'm kind of sick of just seeing beautiful people all the time. And that was one of my complaints about Why the Last Man. I mean, I really enjoyed the story, and the beautiful women were beautiful, but it just seemed like everybody was.
Right.
And
that isn't how it is in real life? They're not all beautiful women?
I don't think so, no.
Let's talk about plot for a minute. Dare I say it, lack thereof.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if I have any real reservation about this, I mean, I can take a jarring moment or two in any story that just makes you scratch your head and go, really? But I think where this really teeters on the edge is that there isn't a whole lot of plot to this. This is an incredibly character-focused story. And, getting back to your talk about the Fight Club guy in his book Haunted, it's the same kind of idea. It's a gathering of characters together to talk about character driven things where nothing really happens. It isn't until probably the fourth issue where something happens to drive the story forward. I mean, lots of little individual things happen to the characters in the first few issues, but the overall story doesn't progress until about the fourth the fourth issue. And even then, it's basically just an excuse to move them to a new location. And that's, I think that's something that's going to have to balance out, because he talks about this being an ongoing story. This isn't a finite series. So finding something for these interesting characters to do is going to be a real challenge.
Sure, and I feel like the world isn't really realistic, and that needs to be fleshed out if it isn't. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, they're murdering people in nightclubs and cops aren't showing up. And so if it's this Sin City type environment, you know, where mm-hmm. everything's just sort of dark, I feel like that really needs to be represented. And I don't know. Those are kind of some of the ridiculous moments that took me out of it.
I think that I think I read somewhere that he said this is a kind of a world in between his Stray Bullets world, which is very, very based in reality, and the Amy race car world that he created in Stray Bullets, which is so far beyond reality, where, you know, the laws of physics are, you know, rendered moot. So I think that this one takes place somewhere in the middle, but you need that a little more.
Yeah, I guess I feel like there was so much development on character, you know, so much focus on the character development that it wasn't really, the world around it wasn't really fleshed out, and right. I feel like those ridiculous moments suffered for it, mm-hmm. whereas they could have been viable. I mean, in Sin City, you see that happen, and you're like, yeah, there's no cops coming, you know?
Right.
But in this world, you don't know really how realistic it is, and it seems fairly realistic except for those moments.
Right.
And I mean, she's surfing on a service tray
behind a cruise ship. Yeah, and that's, I mean, it gets back to that point that this is character driven. It's just, I don't know that they're driving anywhere. They're still sitting around in the car, and, you know, they're interesting to look at and talk to for a while, but eventually you want them to go somewhere and do something.
Sure, and there, I felt like there was no resolution, really, at the end of this book. It didn't feel like this was the end of the trade.
Right, that there was more to come.
Yeah, I mean, it ends on, I don't know, like, not even a cliffhanger. It's just sort of like it just suddenly ends, you know?
Right.
No explanation for why. And so I guess that's a complaint that I have, too, is how the trade ends. And, I mean, we're specifically talking about trades in this podcast.
Right.
And so that's a gripe that I have, just picking up this trade. Mm-hmm. I'm not really satisfied of the story arc from beginning to end. It set everything up, mm-hmm. but that's all it feels like, is a setup. There's no completion of story or real completion of arc.
Right, and it's, what is it setting it up to do? Mm-hmm. I mean, is it setting it up to resolve the you know, just barest essential of a plot that they have that has moved them from New York to, where are they, Monaco or wherever?
I think so.
Is that what they're moving? Is that what he's moving towards an ending of? Is he moving towards a resolution with the Pinkertons and Sadie's family? Is he moving towards an ending with you know, figuring out finally why she got in the limousine? I mean, there's a lot. I think what he does a good job of is, you know, we're talking about all these layers he keeps adding to this, is he's adding and adding and adding. So there's a whole lot there for him to play with and do, but they've got to be moving towards it. They have to be working towards something. I agree. There, nothing got resolved in this, and so it seems like an interesting place to stop. Unless they just wanted to get it out so that, you know, people would read it and start picking up the other issues. I mean,
yeah, and I guess I feel like a trade should sort of be something along the lines of Empire Strikes Back, you know, where there is a cliffhanger, but mm-hmm. there's also a resolution, and you know what's going to happen next. You know what's coming.
Right.
It's somewhat of a feel. And this one just felt like it could have just ended right here and just been a really crappy ending.
Right.
That you're not satisfied with. So I guess those are the issues that I have with it. And one little nitpicky thing that I have is I really hate when they flip around in time and they give you a date. And you're supposed to reference yourself at this date. Mm-hmm. And then they say, okay, like the beginning, it's Friday, March 7th, 2008, and then it flips to sometime 2005, and then it flips to January 12th or something, 2008. Right. And I'm supposed to keep all these dates in my head. It should be date, present day, 3 months ago date, or whatever, you know. I shouldn't have to dig back and, you know, for the minutiae of a detail of a date to figure out where I am in continuity of the story.
Although it does, you know, I agree that it makes for some real headaches. It just goes to show that this works a lot better as a trade. Can you imagine trying to keep all this straight if you're reading this individual issues, you know, one at a time, 6 months spread out from each other? I think the one thing, though, that having those dates for me did, as I was able to flip through it, was it showed me, okay, they met in 2005. They're together now in 2008. There's a whole bunch of history in there that we still have to fill in. And there keeps getting reference to the fact that for a good chunk of that, Sadie didn't even know who Danny was. And so there's a whole story in there that needs to be told about Danny's time with Sadie when they didn't even really know each other.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of helped.
They have kind of alluded to that.
Right.
Somewhat, but
something with the weird clown costume.
Yeah, I didn't get that.
No, it's a really bizarre, again, layer added on to this. That one was, the first time we meet Sadie's dad was one of those jarring moments that took me a minute to get through it. Because everyone had been, you know, a little odd, a little crazy. But, you know, I've met all those people before in my life. I've never met a guy, you know, 70 some years old who's, you know, strapping on his Evel Knievel helmet to go, you know, so he doesn't hurt himself while he's tripping on mushrooms.
Having sex with sisters, right?
Yeah.
Character.
Yeah, it was really, really an over the top moment.
And I get that it was supposed to be, you know, that he is supposed to be the squeaky clean public figure and, you know, oh, he's not.
Right.
I felt like there was no subtlety to that.
No.
Whatsoever.
Well, and if he was the really squeaky clean figure, you know, public figure, then, you know, why were they, when they introduced Sadie to Danny in the first part, why weren't they using the father for that role? They were using, you know, the I don't know, president of the company or whatever. I mean, they were using another public figure, which made it even that much more jarring that the dad was just this total wacko. You know, unless they're trying to show that she was the only normal person in this incredibly insane family.
I mean, there was a whole another layer there with her talking about, like, or her dad was trying to impregnate her with
the spiders from Mars.
Is that supposed to be something that's believable, or something that's supposed to show that she's somewhat crazy or unrealistic?
I took it as being one of those things where, you know, clearly the dad is way out there, and everything that goes on in that house is just beyond the norm. But I really looked at it as there's clearly something going on, and she just lacks the language to explain it. And I think that might be the bullet wound that's, you know, dealing with
that's
it.
That's what I was wondering, yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, clearly there's something going on with the spiders from Mars, but I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe that's
not just, like, mentioned once. That's, like, 3 or 4 times throughout the story.
Yeah, her dad's trying to impregnate her with the spiders from Mars, and, yeah.
I mean,
when she's like that, she's really interesting. I really find the character Sadie interesting, that she just has no fixed personality, no fixed method of operating. What gets me is when she's decided that because she's had sex with Danny, now she's not going to have sex with anyone else, and it's been 72 hours, and she's getting twitchy, and she's punching out guys in the bar just because. I mean, again, it was one of those real over-the-top parts where I think if he would have reeled the character in just a hair, she would be that much more believable and that much more of a sympathetic character. but I don't know.
Do you think that he's trying to build a sympathetic character in her?
I think he has to. I mean, at some level, we have to care about what happens to her. I mean, if we don't care about what happens to her, what's the point? I mean, clearly, Danny cares enough about her. But, you know, Danny's the one we're following. So we have to see enough in her to understand where Danny's coming from. You know, I had a really hard time buying their relationship to start with. You know, all of a sudden it's revealed that he was in love with her, and why did his friend take her out? And, you know, she was the love of my life, and how could you do this to me? And the friend was like, what are you talking about? And that was my whole response, too, is what are you talking about? You know, for all I know, you just saw her for the first time in the garden center. And I think that's the night where he goes with the gun and pulls her out when there's all the people there and the Pinkertons are lighting the place on fire.
Man, I need to reread this again because...
Yeah, it's definitely not a linear comic book. I mean, it really... It's almost cinematic in a way where there's all these flashbacks and taking you to different places and slowly revealing bits and pieces and bits and pieces. And just when you think you have it figured out, there's something new. I mean, I thought I had it all figured out with the gun and, you know, her getting shot the first time. And then they revealed a little bit more. And I was like, oh, wait, no, this is how it happened. And then they revealed a little bit more the third time. And it was like, oh, maybe I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah, that was one thing that I was pretty impressed with, actually, is playing with what you do know and building upon it and twisting it. Because it wasn't like a plot twist in any way. It was just sort of twisting what your understanding of the reality in the world was.
I think that's what's working so well is that he is twisting and manipulating not only the characters, but us as a reader as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Getting back to the musical idea that you were talking about before, I saw this as like punk in that if you get a group of people on stage and you're playing your instruments as loud as possible, it can just be noise. I mean, it can be really, really just horrible noise, but you do it right and you got punk. You know, you've got something really amazing going, and that's kind of what he's doing. He's got these characters and he's playing them as loud as humanly possible. There is no subtlety in these characters. He's playing them so loud, so over the top, and I feel like half the time he's doing it, he's got, you know, some amazing punk rock going here where you're just jumping up and down with the crowd and you're all swept up in it. And sometimes it just is, you know, someone hits just such a jarring note or does something so ridiculously over the top that it's just, that's where it kind of falls apart for me.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I didn't really see a reason for them to change location either. That kind of threw me off.
Yeah, and again, I think it was just the plot part that he needs them to do something. You know, they've got to go somewhere. They have to do something or else it's, you know, four friends or six friends sitting around at a club and talking about their interesting lives and what's going on. And so he kind of needed them to do something, but... That's just a reason to... that plot point to move them in locations was just, you know, something to move the story along. Yeah. It could have been that they needed to go get a sandwich down the street and the exact same things could have happened. You know, so that particular plot element, yeah, I'm with you. I don't know why it had to be that way. I think it probably would have been even a little more interesting if they would have just gone to get a sandwich down the street as opposed to, you know, surfing on a service tray behind a cruise ship. And then that whole thing was just... All right, now, wait. So without spoiling anything for the people that haven't read it, Danny Noonan in this undergoes a major change, I think is a good way to put it. Where the Pinkertons catch up and, you know, he undergoes a major, some could say life-changing experience. Do you think this is something that's going to be a permanent type long-term fixture, or is this just one of those, you know, I threw it in here for shock value type things? And
are you talking about when he basically protects Sadie.
I'm talking about when the Pinkertons catch up with him and he's tied down with the Big C. Yeah. I mean, that seems like that should be a major plot element that has serious long-term consequences, but I kind of just see this as, you know, just one of those things that's just going to happen, and now they're just going to keep tromping along. I mean, I think that's the problem, is that I don't feel like anything they do has any long-term consequence.
Yeah, I feel like that's true, too. I feel like after that event, really, he should have, I don't know, had some of the wind knocked out of him.
Yeah.
And it's just nothing.
Nah.
And, I mean, I think that it's supposed to speak to his absolute obsession with this woman, but I don't know how much further you can go.
Yeah, I mean,
that's...
Go for
basically,
it.
Basically, I mean, he gets his dick cut off, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's what
happens. By a midget in a matador costume.
Yeah. And not as ridiculous as it can get. But then beyond that, like, as soon as he wakes up in the hospital, he's like, we have to go find her.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, there's that Sopranos episode where, you know, they're trying to extort the Jew, the son of the Jew or whatever that, you know, tried to get him in. And they're, like, threatening him with death, threatening him with everything, you know, beating the crap out of him. And so he goes to his friend that's Jewish, and he's like, hey, I've got a problem here. This guy just doesn't even care about his life. And his friend says, what's the one thing that you wouldn't want to live without, or something to that extent? And so they go back and threaten to cut off his, you know, balls or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, all right, I'll sign it, you know? And I felt like this was, like, that was a powerful point to me in that show, and that one that I felt was true. And so for them to go to that extent in here and it to not even faze him,
right?
I just was like, wow.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that I feel like the characters are set, and I think that he's revealing the characters to us. I don't know that there's going to be character development. I mean, if you're going to get your dick chopped off by a midget in a matador suit on a cruise ship to Monaco, and that's not going to have any change in your life, then I think your character's pretty well set. And, you know, like you said, it's like, what else can you possibly do to someone here and have anything happen? So, I mean, I think, yeah, that the characters are set, and we're not, you know, we're just along for the ride as he reveals this to us.
And, I mean, speaking to the fact that after that, you know, I think it's... Big C,
mm-hmm,
said to him, hey, you're bleeding, you know, you gotta stop. And he just completely ignores her and continues on, you know.
Right.
I mean, that speaks to, like, kind of where this character is being taken. And I just don't know how long I can follow that, you know.
Yeah.
Especially if there's no end in sight. I mean, how far can you take that character? There's no arc.
Right.
At that point, you know.
Right. Yeah,
I don't see it.
He, you know, reading an interview, he says that he's got 12 issues for this arc, and then he'll reach a stop, and that's kind of where I look at it too. It's like, okay, what do you do with these characters now? I mean, where can you possibly move them in their lives to keep them, you know, to do something to them, or else they're, you know, everything's going to be been there, you know, done that.
So do you think you're going to pick up the second trade?
I want to pick up the second trade because I want to see some of the resolution to the mysteries that he's layered on. I have no interest in the whether or not, you know, they, you know, what they end up doing with the $50 million painting.
Which is another thing that I find unrealistic. Like, how do you dispense a $50 million painting? I have no sources that I would go to. Like, who do you get in contact with a $50 million painting? You're just like, oh, yeah, we're going to sell it for $50 million. No problem.
Yeah, no. And clearly none of these people are connected enough to even, you know, figure out their own lives, let alone coordinate something major like that. But, you know, I want to know, I mean, I think the biggest mystery for me isn't about the gunshot, isn't about the backstory with, you know, Danny and Sadie. It's the very, very end of the first issue where it says that she knew. On page 20, it says, Sadie says she doesn't remember anything that happened, but she told me since that she knows one of us tricked her into getting in the limo. One of us sold her out. She says when she finds out who, she's going to kill them.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for me, the one part that keeps me interested is that I want to know who sold her out. And I have a really sneaking suspicion that it was either Danny, because, you know, he has to have some purpose in this story. You know, right now his purpose is really just to follow Sadie around, and so he's almost redundant in that. And the other person that would be, you know, and I hate to say it, but Donnie, you know, why else would you have someone that repeatedly is set up as not having a selfish or mean bone in their body, and then...
I think it has to be Donnie, and it's not Danny, only because I think Danny's already carrying around the guilt that, I mean, he shot her, right?
As far as we know, yeah.
And so I think that is his cross to bear, you know, through this. And so I feel like it is Donnie. I think you hit it right on the head, you know.
Because I don't know who else it could be to be a really satisfying twist. I mean, everyone else has...
They really set him up. I mean, Donnie isn't perfect either. I mean, he's a junkie.
Right.
I mean, so they've already set it up. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, I mean, he could... And he's wanted, you know, to save up for his cafe or whatever. So I feel like they've already set it up right there, even though they say that he's doesn't have a mean bone in his body. I mean, everybody knows what a junkie's like, or at least the portrayal of a junkie.
Right. Well, and, you know, 2 pages later when Donnie is scoring the smack, he says to the dealer, Sadie said she'd get the rest, I swear. And the dealer says, that crazy bitch better. So, you know, Donnie's already leveraging Sadie's, you know, reputation or name.
Is this in the same continuity?
Or yeah, that's...
a different time.
And that is... Because she... She, Donnie gets up to go to the ladies' room right before, Runko shows up.
Is this,
but it is
present day, or was this, yeah, this is present.
This is present day. The part about the limo was a couple of months back.
Okay. See, for me, I'm not hooked by any of those mysteries, and really I just want to see if he can pull it off, because that's all I'm really interested in right now. I mean, he's made these over the top characters, and I want to see what the payoff is, you know, right, to see if he can pull it off and make it worth my while. And so I am going to pick up the second trade for sure. Even though I thought this was good, I didn't like it. Which is interesting. I don't know that there's too many comics that I've read where I thought it was good and I didn't enjoy it.
You know, I think I liked it for the sheer mayhem of it all. This is one of the few comics I think I really would have enjoyed better in single issue format. Not the continuity hopping where you got to go back in time, but every month getting this, you know, 120-page dose of this mayhem. That's one thing, you know, and I can go, you know, once a month I get, you know, somebody doing something totally crazy, but to read it back to back to back like this.
I think that's true. I feel like because I don't normally sit down and read a trade all at once. For me, I like to spread it over, you know, a series of time. But to get this podcast in, I read it all at once, and it was a serious dose of, I don't know. I just felt uncomfortable the whole time.
Yeah,
really interesting.
I'm like you. I liked it, but really hesitantly. I just don't know that, you know, unless there's a major payoff at the end of the second trade. I don't see following these characters any further. I mean, you know, getting back to, you know, to the comparison to, you know, Fight Club and Haunted, you know, the difference between the two books for me is that, you know, they both have incredibly, at best, morally ambiguous characters, and at worst, morally reprehensible characters. Yeah. And there's a huge payoff at the end of Fight Club. I mean, there's a plot that moves forward. It builds to a conclusion. There's a fantastic payoff at the end of it. And I leave that book feeling satisfied and wishing I had more. I get to the end of, you know, Haunted, and there isn't that kind of payoff. There isn't that kind of feeling of, you know, something major happened here. And so, yeah, unless something major happens to these characters, or something major happens to the story, I'm not sure that I'm going to want to come back for more. And, you know, and looking at his other work, I think that's why his work like Stray Bullets worked for as long as it did, is that it didn't necessarily follow the same characters through every stage. You know, it did a lot of this weaving back and forth in time, but it did it longer format, so you'd have a couple of issues taking place at this time involving this character that tangentially tied in over here. It was more like he was creating a universe than it was that he was telling a linear story. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's what we'll get. Maybe we'll get more of a Young Liars universe feel. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that I'm going to follow it through the next trade and then see how I feel after that's over. Mm-hmm. If he pulls it off, I don't know, I may really enjoy it, but as it stands right now, I didn't enjoy it, but I did feel it was good.
Yeah. So there you go. So there's Young Liars, Volume 1 from Vertigo and DC, $9.99, available at your local comic retailer. You can find us at stumptowntradereview.blogspot.com. Oh, no.